Here's another great example. Ayn Rand, right?
Yeah.
Ayn Rand is not a philosopher. Well, she is. She's just not a good one.
Yeah, there you go. That's nice. So, yeah.
You know, sometimes we're using philosopher in a like classificatory way, and sometimes we're using it in an evaluative way.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just like who gets to be in our little club, you know?
That's right. Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. I'm your host, Parker Setacase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. Today's episode is another very special one. I have with me Dr. Greg Sadler, and we're going to be talking about public philosophy and Philip K. Dick, which I'm really excited about. A lot of you will know that I have a Philip K. Dick tattoo, and we're going to be talking about the book behind that. So I'm pretty excited about that. Before I jump in, though, I want to thank everyone who's making this podcast happen over on Patreon. You guys are awesome. If this is your top 5, top 10, maybe even top 15 favorite podcast, please consider becoming a Patreon patron. You can find the link in the description, wherever you're getting this podcast at. And there's a lot of different levels that you can give at. And there's different benefits, perks at each level. So check that out. Also, if you're watching on YouTube, you can find the merchandise, the store. You can find that as one of the things to browse through on my homepage. You can find the store directly. Look at all the Parker's Pensies merch. I've been working with Chase Hahn, and there's some really, really cool stuff. So go check that out. Another way to support the podcast is down here. There's a super thanks button. You can give above and beyond the Patreon or just a one-time gift. You can buy a cup of coffee or something like that. Appreciate that. There's lots and lots of ways to give, lots of ways to connect with me. You can find the Discord server. You can find our Facebook group, Parker's Pensies Penseurs. Lots of ways. Twitter, Facebook, all that good stuff. You can find me. And I'm still a small enough program where I will respond to your stuff so far. No promises in the future when I am giant and bigger than Joe Rogan and all that stuff. But without further ado, let's bring in Greg and let's get talking about public philosophy, who counts as a philosopher, what is philosophy, and all sorts of other stuff. Here we go. Greg, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, man.
Yeah, thanks for bringing me on.
Yeah, this is huge. I've really been enjoying your channel lately, especially because I've seen your work on Philip K. Dick, and super, super exciting. Before we jump into that, though, I want to find out from you, how did you get into philosophy in the first place?
It was pretty random. I come from a family that doesn't have an awful lot of, you know, at least at that time, college grads, let alone academics in it. Now it's kind of changed with the, you know, the younger generation. And I took two philosophy classes when I was in high school. One was actually called a philosophy class, and it was just terrible, and it would have turned me off forever. It was very dry, you know, very dull. The teacher wasn't a good teacher. And then I had a really good class that was supposed to be a sacraments class. And they brought in this little guy from Seattle as a substitute teacher. And he decided he was going to teach us about Augustine, which meant that if he was going to do, you know, if he was going to explain Augustine properly, he needed to teach us some philosophy. So we did some Plato and some Aristotle. We weren't actually like reading texts. He would just get up to the board and explain ideas. And then we'd chat about it. And, I that kind of opened my eyes to it. And then went in the army, you know, read a few things here and there, and then got out and went to college. And when I got to college, my mom's boyfriend or previous boyfriend had said, as soon as you get to college, declare a major right away. That way you're not just lost in a whole sea of freshmen. You'll like hook up with professors and you know, they'll kind of guide you. Yeah. So I looked down this list and I was like, philosophy, that sounds cool. I think I could get into that. And I just started taking classes and it kept on going. And then I graduated, and in the year between when I was working, going, you know, I had to decide what I was going to do. Should I go to grad school for philosophy? I'd also majored in math. So should I go to grad school for math, or should I just like take the actuarial exams? And I decided for philosophy. And fortunately, I wound up in a good place for studying it, where I didn't get turned off by, you know, very restrictive approaches, or, you know, the need for prestige or stuff like that. It was a pluralistic department where we had lots of different people, you know, representing different perspectives. And there were, the, you know, there was the possibility of like taking Greek classes with the classic department, or you know, stuff in continental philosophy with the speech comm department, or stuff on rhetoric with the English department. And so I just kept, you know, kind of plowing away. So you could say that I stayed in philosophy in part out of inertia, you know, like a forward movement inertia. Yeah. But I, you know, I was always attracted to this, like, you know, digging into ideas. We talk about the big questions like how should I live, or, you know, what's real, and, you know, those sorts of things. Those have always been of interest to me. And philosophy was one of the places where you got to explore that. Not exclusively. I mean, you could explore it in other fields, but it seemed like that was the best place to go. Right. Yeah. And so, you know, I was really fortunate in that, you know, I've had the opportunity to be a professor. I've done other stuff with philosophy. I think it's a bit tougher for younger people now. You know, the job market's pretty bad. So it's, you know, I kind of lucked out having come up in the 90s when I did.
Well, so some people will have like the plan B job, which is like, you know, YouTube or Substack. For me, that's plan A, because I know a lot of people who don't have jobs who apply to 300, 500 other applicant jobs and stuff. So I want to do this. I think this is awesome. You kind of have the plan B thing going already. You have 123,000 subscribers, like 2,500 videos on YouTube. How'd you get into like the public philosophy game?
Well, like everything else, without any proper planning or due diligence.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Just kind of stumbling into things and again, lucking out. With the YouTube thing, I got into doing YouTube and uploading videos, I want to say around 2010. And it was my, at that time, fiance, now wife, who convinced me to start uploading content.
Smart lady.
Yeah, she'd given me a flip cam. When there was actually a company called Flip before they went out of business. And she bought it for me for like chronicling my time with my kids in the summer. But she, you know, she was also like, well, you know, you can record your classes. People are doing that thing these days. And I was like, who'd want to watch this? You know, I'm a nobody teaching at some, you know, little historically black university in the South that hardly has, you know, a tech budget. And she's like, well, just try it out. I mean, what do you have to lose? You know, and that's actually a kind of a good way to approach it. There's zero, you know, what's going to happen? People say mean comments or something. And it turned out that there were a lot of, I would say that my stuff caught on, not because of any intrinsic goodness or greatness to what I do, but because it was easy to stand out because so much of the academic teaching at the time was so bad. So a lot of the comments in the first couple of years are things like, my professor won't explain anything. And he'd be like, what the hell's going on there? Right. Thank God for your video. Cause otherwise I couldn't, you know, I wouldn't have made it through Plato. Right. Yeah. And you're like, wow, there must be a lot of really bad teachers out there. Mm-hmm. And then there were people who were also like, I can't afford to go to college, or I had to drop out. You know, this is really nice because I get to feel like I'm in class again. And it just kind of grew organically, you know, and then people started asking me, sometimes pestering me, hey, would you do a video on this? Would you do a video on this? And sometimes I was receptive and I'd be like, yeah, I could do some stuff on existentialism. I think I know something about that. Or, yeah, I could do some stuff on Hegel, you know, jumping into the half-hour Hegel series without realizing how much work I was making for myself, you know. And so I would do things like that. And then later on, I got better at like thinking about where the gaps were that I should shoot stuff on or what I really wanted to be doing. But I've never been a great planner. You know, I think a lot of people get into doing, you know, content production, right? And they like plan things out. They got a calendar in advance. Yeah. And I just, you know, that never worked for me. So like the Dick stuff, you know, I just decided, yeah, you know, I've been rereading this stuff. It's kind of cool. I've got this series on speculative fiction. Why not do Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And then after that, I was like, well, he's got another piece over here on the android and the human. Why not do something on that? You know?
Yeah.
So it involved putting off some of the other stuff that I had committed to doing this summer that people were really looking forward to. Like that I'll do later this month, like stuff on Schopenhauer.
Okay.
But you know, sometimes you got to just, you know, do the stuff you're interested in.
Yeah, right? Totally. Yeah. For me, I was like, I need to watch more of your stuff. And I was looking at like the more continental type stuff. And it's like, okay, cool. You know, I'll make some time for it. And then I saw like Bob Pepper's picture. I have it as the background, Bob Pepper's picture of Philip K. Dick. And I was like, okay, well, that's it. I have to drop everything I'm doing and watch it. I got the shirt. I'm wearing the shirt for you right now.
Well, I mean,
got it tattooed on my arm here.
If you're a dickhead, you know.
Yeah.
That's right. You can't get enough dick, right?
That's right.
So, I mean, that's the funny thing is you get to make all these jokes.
That's right. Yeah, it's amazing. Well, Greg, man, so what did you do your dissertation on? You said you have like this eclectic team that you got to study with. Where was that? And then, what was the topic?
Yeah, so I went to Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, which at that time was quite a great place to be, but now is really in you know, a rough situation because the state of Illinois like didn't fund the colleges and universities for a couple of years during the financial crisis, and the department is like just decimated. But
Greg, I went to Northern Illinois, so I know all about it, man. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's Northern is not in great shape either, frankly.
Right. Yeah,
but it's not as bad as Southern. Interestingly, Edwardsville, because there's Southern Illinois Carbondale,
SIUE.
Yeah, they're doing great.
I know, man. Their wrestling program's great. Like, I don't know what's up with them. They got a good social media program too.
Somehow they got plenty of money to do things, and the philosophy department's got like, you know, about what we had back then, which is like 15 full-time professors.
Wow. That's huge.
Yeah. So I had kind of a weird, eclectic, meandering around thing when I was there. I came in and I was originally going to do philosophy of language, and I'd done a lot of stuff in analytic philosophy of language, and then a lot of stuff in continental philosophy of language. And I was actually like studying languages too at the time. And then I veered out of that into, I mean, I guess you could call it continental. I was interested in like writing my dissertation on Hegel for a while. Took Hegel as my special thinker when I had to do my preliminary examinations. And I was basically told memorize the phenomenology, you know, and all of its dialectics, and then get some of the logic in there too.
Okay.
And I was able to do it back then. I don't think I could now. But I, you know, like I mentioned, I got to take classes with other departments. I started getting into a lot of history of philosophy stuff. You know, once I'd learned Greek, I could, you know, read Plato and Aristotle and the original, and that opened up a lot of doors. And reading, you know, Anselm and Aquinas and people like that in Latin was pretty eye-opening too. And so I wrote my dissertation on this guy who at one time was kind of a big name and now is almost completely forgotten, Maurice Blondel, who was a French Catholic philosopher back when that was being, you know, being like a committed Catholic was enough to get you essentially blackballed within the French Academy. He didn't, he didn't get work for a couple of years and then they put him out in the boonies. But he was okay with that, you know, cause he liked teaching. And I, you know, the stuff that I did in my dissertation, the committee gave me a lot of freedom and latitude to do what I wanted. And so I produced this gigantic sprawling 450 page document that was just unpublishable, you know, and I haven't looked at it in years, frankly, because, but it was good to do, you know, all the research that goes into it was kind of fun. And you know, your first, your dissertation is your first book. So you're learning how to effectively write a book. It just so happens that one only got published in, you know, a few copies that I think are still in the library there or something. Actually, I mean, the copy that I have is in WordPerfect. So I'm pretty sure that all the codes don't work anymore.
Oh, wow. Nice.
I should have created a PDF of it way back then.
Yeah, but seriously. Now they're going to be clamoring for it over on your YouTube channel. Let's see, like, let's go through point by point and.
Yeah, I mean, it would be kind of a hot mess, I think. Going from memory. That'd
be fun to go back.
I mean, after that, I mean, like, I got into all sorts of little, you could call them rabbit holes. Like, I did a lot of work on Thomas Hobbes for a while and on Aristotle and thinkers in the Christian philosophy debates in the 1930s. That's what my first book was on. And, you know, if I found something that I was interested in, I was teaching full time and that was, I enjoyed that. Like my first job was teaching at Indiana State Prison, in Ball State University's, degree program, but it gave me a lot of time for doing research and writing. And so I just kind of pursued whatever interests I had. And, I wouldn't advise that to a lot of people cause it's not going to like get you jobs or build your brand or reputation, but it worked good for me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it seems like you had all this time, this space and freedom to learn philosophy, like not just one, you know, analytic, language or something like that. What, I've been meaning to ask, like, what kind of philosophy do you practice today? Are you just philosophy generally construed or do you find yourself in a particular tradition more than others?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I say that I'm an eclectic, which means that I draw upon multiple schools and traditions. There's some that matter more to me and I draw on more heavily. And then there's some that I just like totally ignore, right? Because you can't possibly do everything. But as time went on, I got more and more interested in history of philosophy in a broad sense. So not just doing history of philosophy where we're like trying to locate a philosopher in their historical context and say, you know, Leibniz had eggs this morning and that's why he wrote this piece this way. But more like, you know, what do these people that we acknowledge as important thinkers, what do they have to offer us in the present? Mm-hmm. And so there's a connection between history of philosophy understood in the right way and then philosophy as a way of life.
Yeah.
The phrase that Pierre Hadot made really famous, but which plenty of people have done besides Hadot. And then, you know, that's going to bleed over into some analytic philosophy and some continental philosophy. Like take Hegel, for example. Like you can approach Hegel and be really interested in him as a continental philosophy person. And then there's certain things that you're going to pay attention to and other things you're not going to pay attention to, right? If you're interested in him more in terms of history of philosophy, there's other things you're going to pay closer attention to. So, you know, you can have multiple lenses, you could say. And you know, where I went to grad school, we had analytic philosophers who had tried to push everybody out of the department and failed. And so they were a little bit humbled, you know.
Okay.
And then we had continental philosophers. And then we had classical American philosophy, which was kind of unusual because most American universities don't have that. But, you know, we had two Dewey scholars and a Peirce scholar and people doing work on James and the Transcendentalists. So that was good. I'm really happy that I got exposed to that, although I kind of got sick of Dewey after, you know, after you hear how great he is, you know, a million times.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there was that. And then, like I said, I got to study history of philosophy by working with the classics department and the English department. And it was, you know, I think that it wouldn't have worked out for everybody. Like some people really need something structured. But you know, the other thing was, too, SIU had an amazing research library, which I think now is not, again, in such great shape. But I didn't realize just how good it was until I started looking at other higher tier schools that had lesser libraries where you can't find as much stuff. Because I just go in and wander around and, you know, pick out stuff and read it if I wanted to, you know. So that was really, it was a great time to be there.
Yeah. Sounds like it, man. So something I like to ask guests is about the analytic continental divide. Or so-called divide, so, you know. What do you make of that? Is that some people will tell me it's passé and we're kind of past that. Others will say, of course not. No. There's a very sharp distinction. What do you make of it? And quick, I think sometimes I've got this kind of view that the Continentals ask really good questions, but they're really confusing, and the analytics maybe less confusing, but sometimes, you know, they get pretty confusing as well, but they'll focus on, like, you know, does this chair exist? And I think that's an important question, but maybe they don't have the best questions. So I don't know. Well, that's just a loose caricature and it's not accurate, but what do you make of that?
I think the divide is a very parochial way of understanding the world of philosophy, and it's artificial and doesn't really apply to, you know, the majority of the centuries that philosophy has been done. Analytic philosophy is roughly, you know, if you want to trace it back to Frege, maybe 150 years old tops. Continental philosophy, you know, where should we start? Maybe like Hegel and Schelling. That's not that old either. And you know, during a lot of this time, they weren't understanding themselves in those categories. The analytics were more than the Continentals. And I'll also say too that continental philosophy and actual European philosophy are not the same thing.
Okay.
So, like, you know, if you think about some of the traditions in, because continental philosophy comprises a bunch of different traditions, you know, the phenomenological movement and, you know, structuralism and post-structuralism, which might coincide with it a bit, but might also not. You know, you've got things like European Thomism, which is really active through most of the late 19th and 20th centuries, but doesn't make it into so-called continental philosophy very often. And, you know, there'll be like lots of areas where the American version of what counts as continental or the British version leaves out all these other important thinkers, you know, that are important in European history. So even continental philosophy is kind of a made up thing in some respects.
Yeah.
So to make a, like, philosophy is divided basically into analytic and continental. Well, what about the whole history of philosophy, you know, or what about Chinese and Indian philosophy, just to take the two like biggest other cultural spheres? And what about comparative philosophy when we bring Western philosophy into contact with, say, Chinese philosophy? Or what about, you know, radical, you know, critical types of philosophy that don't fit neatly into analytic or continental? You know, feminism is not something
that's what I was thinking of.
Or, you know, and you've got other traditions, you know, the Marxist tradition doesn't fit neatly into either one of these. You've got what we call philosophy as a way of life, or what Alistair McIntyre calls tradition constituted rationalities. You know, he's a great example because he went from being an analytic and a Marxist to this neo-Aristotelian and then beyond. So there's all these different possibilities, and so I think it's not as if analytic philosophy isn't important and continental philosophy aren't important, but they're like two siblings that get into fights with each other and ignore everybody else in the room, and they get most of the attention, right?
And
we're in a time now where I think analytic philosophy has kind of, you know, there is no longer a canon that everybody reads. It's not like if you came up today in analytic philosophy, you're definitely going to read Quine, or, I mean, you might not even read Wittgenstein for that matter.
And that's true. That's true. I mean, hopefully, you know, I really don't like Wittgenstein, but I mean, everyone will have to read, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? You know, that's maybe one.
Maybe. I mean, I never had to read that anywhere.
But interesting.
Yeah. So there's not like a common canon. The vocabulary means one thing from one area. So like you say, externalism, well, that means one thing in philosophy of action, a different thing in epistemology. And so, you know, the analytics are in what we often call post-analytic phase, where there's no internal consistency other than like being opposed to the continentals and having a certain kind of vocabulary that includes big terms like intuition and defeater and, you know, stuff like that. Right.
That's right.
And the continental side is just as messy, and, you know, there are attempts to like schematize it. Like there's this great reader by Richard Kearney that people often will assign if you're going to teach continental philosophy, right? It's got three nice, neat traditions: the phenomenological hermeneutical tradition, the Marxist critical theory tradition, and then the structuralist and post-structuralist tradition. But when you get down to like actual thinkers and you're like, okay, where does Paul Ricoeur fit in? Oh, well, he straddles all three of these. Or, you know, well, why isn't Maurice Blondel in there, or you know, Gabriel Marcel? Well, because they're, you know, existentialists, or you know, Catholic writers, and they don't fit neatly into this scheme. So you know, they're both kind of a mess, right? And it's not as if history of philosophy is totally coherent either. So
I've gotten a lot of random ones from my time studying theology. Like, so Paul Ricoeur will come up because a particular theologian, Kevin Van Hooser would use him, and so I'd have to look up Ricoeur, and then I talk with my analytic philosopher friends. I'm like, yeah, I'm reading Paul Ricoeur, and they're like, who? I'm like, dang it, all this work for nothing, you know?
You know, the irony is that he is one of the people who, you know, came from Europe, so you can call him a continental philosopher, and he deliberately engaged the analytic philosophy of his time. He was a bridge builder, you know? So he's like referencing Max Black and I think Davidson and the Rule of Metaphor.
Oh,
so,
snap, okay.
So they should know him, but they don't, because they don't read enough.
Yeah, that's something. Something with my analytic friends, and I don't want to bash them. I love them. I definitely probably lean closer to their side. But in writing analytic philosophy and learning the tradition, I would go. I came from theology, and in theology, it was like you have to represent everyone perfectly well, and you have to have a ton of sources to show that you read everything everyone. And all of a sudden, you have to do that. And I would do that, and they'd be like, "What's all this stuff? What are all these notes?" I'm like, "Dude, I'm showing you that I read this stuff." They're like, "I don't care. Just make the argument and stipulate. Let this be true. Let this, you know, if he's saying this, then we can do. Make it a conditional." I was like, "Oh, that's easier, but scary and terrifying to me." So I'm still learning the trade.
Yeah, and it's good to think of it as like you can do the same stuff, but you can write it in different modes, right? So like, you could write a piece that has the whole lit review. And you just take that out for the analytics.
They
don't have to know that it's there. It's like when, so, you know, this is a different context, but when I go in and I do like workshops or consultations with business clients, like actual businesses, I'm not telling them that the stuff about like emotional management is coming from Aristotle or Thomas Aquinas or the Stoics, unless they ask me, right?
Okay.
Because if I were to say, well, you know, Aristotle told us this stuff about anger, their eyes are going to glaze over and they're going to be like, I'm not listening to this bozo, you know? So I just tell them the stuff, sort of presenting the argument, right? And then they're like, oh, this is amazing. This is magic. And then I'll be like, this is coming from Aristotle, or this is coming from Epictetus. You know, maybe you should read them, and then they're more receptive to it, right?
Wow, yeah, that's so cool. That's a great method there. I'm randomly thinking about people who are building bridges. Any thoughts on like Michael Pugliani? Have you looked at his stuff at all?
I've only read a little bit of his stuff, but I've liked what I've read. The Great Transformation was a book that nobody had suggested in my classes, but I found it at a bookstore and I was paging through it and I was like, this seems pretty cool. And then you read it. And so he's a good example of somebody who could talk a couple different lingos, you know?
Right. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. He's kind of weird. And again, another guy I got introduced to because of theology, and I'm trying to make sense in certain circles in theology. It's like, you haven't read Pugliani? What's your problem? To tacit dimension. And then you go to other places and I'm like, yeah, so, you know, about tacit knowledge. And they're like, wait, what are you talking about? I study epistemology. What are you talking about? Tacit knowledge. And it's like, dang it.
Yeah.
But I've learned to embrace it. And I actually enjoy it. And I'm looking to you as it's kind of an example of saying, I just want, if it's philosophy, I want to know it. If other people take this to be philosophy, then I want to learn that and be able to talk intellectually about it.
Yeah, that's a really useful way to go about it, right? Mm-hmm. I think you put your finger on something important. If other people are willing to say this is worth reading, instead of just like saying, oh, well, it doesn't fit into this structure that I got taught, you know, so therefore it's crap, you know, what the hell do they know? Right. You look at people who you respect, and if they're willing to take somebody seriously, then, you know, maybe the first time you read them, you didn't get something out of the person, but you're like, well, you know, if Heidegger thinks that there's something here, there's probably something here, you know, if you pick whoever else you want. I think there's a lot of what we do in philosophy. We present it as if it's like universal reason and, you know, there's no contingency in what I'm doing. It's all pure necessity and, you know, everything follows logic. That's not how we do philosophy. That's not how anyone's ever done philosophy.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah. You know, I mean, who did Hegel read? It was very much contingent on who people thought you ought to read at the time and then where his proclivities led him, you know, and nobody can read everybody. So I think I think it's a great idea to rely upon this. I don't know if you can make it an argument, but like so-and-so whose opinion I respect thinks that this person over here is worth reading or this work is worth reading. Therefore, I'm going to give it a chance, you know?
Yeah. I like that. I think also one thing that was frustrating for me was I made the switch. I'm studying philosophy and people would say, oh, cool. So like, what do you think of Nietzsche? Right. And be like, well, first is Nietzsche maybe. Right. But no, look, I'm studying analytic philosophy and they're like, oh, well, I thought he was a philosopher. And like, okay, well, what do I do here? And then I was like, well, fine, let me just read him. I'm sick. Sixth person asking me, fine, I will read him. And then I'll be able to just talk with you. Cause the whole point of me studying is I want to talk with people about ideas. Yeah. If they're asking me about these types of ideas, then I'm going to learn those ideas and I'm going to be able to talk with people about those.
Yeah. Yeah. That's useful. I mean, you can't read everybody.
No,
right?
That's the problem.
And
it seems like you've read everyone. I don't know.
No. There's huge gaps, you know?
Okay.
And actually that's one of the questions I often get from people who are starting out in philosophy. They get dismayed because they walk into the library and they're like, oh crap, I'm never going to be able to read all this stuff. And even if I do, I'm not going to remember most of it. So therefore, how do I know I'm reading the right stuff? And the answer is, you don't until you like, you know, you get something out of it. I mean, we can be pretty confident that reading Plato and Aristotle and the Stoics and Augustine and Cicero is going to be helpful for you. But, you know, beyond that, who else should you read? Well, you know, you have to kind of play around. And if you're spending a lot of time with ancient philosophy, you only get 24 hours a day. So you can't spend that time reading Nietzsche or, you know, people that are similar to him, but are not just saying exactly the same thing, like say Max Stirner, you know? So everybody's got huge gaps, you know?
And I think Peter Adamson, he's got a history of philosophy without any gaps.
Right? That's because he sourced it out to other people, right? I bet if we looked at it close enough, we'd find gaps. I'll be really curious to see if Maurice Blondel is in it when he gets to
there we go.
Philosophy, you know?
Yeah.
There's probably going to be some. I haven't looked at it too carefully myself, but yeah, you're always going to have some stuff that you didn't get to, and you know, you could regret it, and you're not even really regretting it because you don't know what you haven't gotten to, right? It's sort of like saying, I've never been to Albuquerque. Actually, I've never been further west than whichever one is further west, Omaha or Denver, and I was only there for conferences, so I didn't get to really see any of them. So I've never been to Albuquerque, and I've seen, you know, Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
So I've seen a little bit of Albuquerque, and maybe I've seen something in some other show that had Albuquerque in it, but I don't know what I'm missing, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't have to worry about that, you know? There's enough other stuff that I can concentrate on closer to town. You know, I could say like, There's cities in Wisconsin, my home state, that I haven't been to that would probably be cool for me to go to. I've been to most of the things that count as cities, but, you know, go further north and maybe I haven't hit those. That's closer to home. I should go there instead of Albuquerque.
Yeah.
Right. And then maybe there's nothing there. Maybe it's just a bunch of silos and, you know, a couple strip malls and.
But if you meet a person from there, you get to say, yeah, I've been there. I know that silo. Yeah, I saw that old tilting silo. And they go, you saw that silo? And they freak out.
That's because we're social beings, right?
Yeah,
We care about, you know, where we came from and that other people think that's important. And
Well, and that's how I feel about some of the obscure works, where it's like if you can just read an obscure piece.
Yeah,
you bump into someone who did their dissertation on that. They will like kiss you. They're like, "What? Are you serious? No one else knows this guy at all." Like the Jansenists. Holy cow, man! No one knows Pascal was a Jansenist. You know, like this whole thing.
Yeah.
I love that. I love getting in deep with where someone like lives. It's so cool. But Greg, man, I wanted to see if we could get a definition of philosophy. Like, what is it that we're talking about?
I don't have one. I mean, I actually start my intro students off with like a whole list of proposed definitions of philosophy.
Yeah.
And then we talk about why they work for some kinds of philosophy, but not others.
Mm-hmm.
I have gotten to the point where I can at least say that philosophy consists in several things connected with each other and that they're like tools that we see philosophers using, you know, like making distinctions or making arguments or stuff like that. And, you know, you can look at philosophy as a literature, which it certainly is. You go to like a bookstore. Now, you know, most bookstores are going to have some kind of cheesy, crappy stuff in there with the philosophy stuff.
That's right.
But that's every okay. Time. You know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, philosophy is an activity. It's something that we do. Like we could say we're doing philosophy right now, you know, and then it's depending on which approach you're taking, it's something that's got its own kind of norms and traditions to it, right? And it's, you know, it's got its own objects, which are also the objects of other disciplines. But they get looked at maybe in more generality or in different ways, you know, with more freedom sometimes, right?
Yeah.
And it is a discipline, but man, I mean, you think about like the 2000 plus universities and colleges that we have here in the United States, you like look at philosophy departments from one to the next, not saying that you could actually compare all 2000, however many else there are, but just like some, and you're like, well, the discipline of philosophy over here has some commonalities with the discipline of philosophy over here, but they definitely are not the same, you know, from one to the next.
Yeah. Well, so with that in mind, then who gets to call themselves a philosopher?
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, in a way it's, and this is, goes all the way back to Plato's Republic. He notes this problem. Anybody can call themselves a philosopher if they want to. Right. Mm. And maybe it'll stick, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. And very often some of the people who are doing, let's call it better philosophy or more philosophical philosophy, are not going to be recognized by those who've kind of taken over the field, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, anybody can call themselves anything. It's whether it gets bought into by other people and whether it gets bought into by the people who maybe are better informed or, you know, but there isn't going to be any real consensus. I mean, you're going to see people say Heidegger wasn't a real philosopher. He's just making up bullshit words, you know, and you're like, no, I mean, he does have a tendency to like, you know, be a little full of himself at times. And he does make up terms.
Yeah.
They're not just like totally made up, right? He's explaining them in it. And you could say Wittgenstein wasn't a philosopher, or pick whoever else you want. Or here's another great example, Ayn Rand, right?
Yeah.
Ayn Rand is not a philosopher. Well, she is. She's just not a good one.
Yeah, there you go. That's nice. So, yeah.
You know, sometimes we're using philosopher in a like classificatory way, and sometimes we're using it in an evaluative way.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just like who gets to be in our little club, you know?
That's right. The evaluative one is, I hold philosophers in such a high regard. I think like for a culture to have philosophers, like I love it. That's why I want to be one. You know, I love, so I'm like, oh no, Ayn Rand. And like, maybe we even like exclude Will Durant because his book was so bad and has such like, you know, such bad ramifications.
You know, I'll tell you something. This is a total tangent, right?
Yeah.
So I started doing these videos lately, calling out fake quotes, because there's like way too many fake quotes attributed to Plato or Aristotle or whoever.
Yeah.
And I found that William Durant, given his propensity to like paraphrase and to give you his take about what people are doing, he is one of the supplier, even though he didn't intend to do it, of fake quotes, because people will read his book and they're like, they take something out of there and they'll say like, well, this is what Aristotle actually said. And it's not what Aristotle said.
Yeah.
And it's instead what Durant is saying that Aristotle said. And usually Durant's getting it half right, half wrong, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So, they can just be traced back to him. Well, that's sometimes, you know, it's always in the bookstores.
It's perennially, what would you call it? It's a bestseller forever.
Yeah. Right. And so someone would be like, hey, look at this book I got. And it's like, oh man, you should, well, let me think. Who should you do? Well, like Copelston's. But then it's like, well, good luck, because now you have 15 or whatever, 20 volumes here. Let me give you these instead of this nice little Will Durant one.
Yeah. I mean, Copelston is the guy that was kind of the standard when I was in grad school. But looking back on it, he does some philosophers better than others, you know.
Okay.
Even he's got some, I mean, he's certainly got gaps, right?
Yeah.
And then he's also got places where you're like, well, I don't know that the Stoics were actually just about this, you know?
Yeah.
So
that seems like it's the case with so much lately, where, I mean, you can look on like TikTok or something and you see like, did you think this growing up? Well, actually, no. You know, like, look at the food pyramid. Actually, no. And like the Stoics or the Epicureans, the Epicureans wouldn't have, stuff their face all the time. Like, you guys got it wrong. It's like, dang it. Like, everything is so wrong. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, any philosophical term that, especially those that are assigned to like a particular school or derived from a founder, is pretty much going to mean it won't be the opposite. Thankfully, but it'll be something quite different. So like, Epicureans, it's not just like pure, unabashed hedonism. Stoic doesn't mean repressing emotions, even though lowercase s. Cynic doesn't mean just being a jerk, you know. Right. And we could go on and on and on. I was actually thinking at one point about like doing a there's this thing called Listenable, right? And it's one of these many platforms you can like produce classes on.
Okay.
And it's audio stuff, right? So they want the lectures to be like 3 to 10 minutes and nice and short and for a general audience. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool to do a class where you take all these terms, like, you know, Platonic, you know, the Platonic idea of something, you know, if you've got the Platonic idea of something, you're not going to be able to see it. Hmm. So I'm not the Platonic ideal of a philosopher. This is not the Platonic ideal of a book, right? But we use it that way all the time, right? And so I thought it'd be kind of cool to go through and like say, okay, what did the original meaning consist in back then? What are people calling it now? What's the difference between them? I think that would be really helpful for a lot of people, right?
I think you're right. Helpful and so frustrating, because sometimes when I learn the meanings of words or of different schools of philosophy, I try so hard not to be like the actually guy. So something will come up. Someone will tell me, the hardest one for me is someone will be like, that's so trivial. And I'm like, ooh, that relates to the trivium, which is, you know, logic, grammar, and what is it? Trivial. Logic, grammar, and rhetoric. And it's like, if anything, we need to get trivial. We need to be trivial. But us pragmatic Americans have flipped the meaning, and now trivial's bad.
There's another one like that. Oh, that's just semantics. And you're like, semantics is like the whole study of meaning.
Right, so right. It matters. It's kind of important. Yeah, totally, man. Well, with the idea of who gets to be called a philosopher, I wanted to transition to talk a little bit about Philip K. Dick, because
absolutely.
Man, I picked him up because my dad writes some sci-fi himself, and he's obsessed with science fiction. The Star Is My Destination, by Alfred Best, maybe, I forgot who wrote that.
Yeah, that's Bester. Yeah.
Yeah, Bester. Yeah, loves it and made us read it as kids, and it was a little graphic for me as a kid, but. But from there, got into Philip K. Dick, and just like, man, I love him. He's crazy. He's like C.S. Lewis if he took LSD and lost like a lot of his hope, maybe. But I came to find out that like he studied some philosophy in undergrad, and so some of this made some sense. Do you think that when you think of Philip K. Dick, obviously everyone says, well, sci-fi author, and you know, Blade Runner, you know, the book behind Blade Runner. Do you think of him as a philosopher? Can we rightly call him that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, if we broaden the sense enough, maybe, but then we'd have to say that he's a philosopher who does his philosophy through literary media, right?
Yeah.
And not just like philosophical dialogues like, say, Plato or the other dialogue writers, but through, I mean, this is part of what I really love about Dick is he's eminently philosophical, like Dostoevsky is. Also like Shakespeare is, right?
Mm.
Or Jorge Luis Borges or Ursula K. Le Guin. And he'll have his characters working through ideas from philosophy, psychology, and theology, sometimes in dialogue with each other, sometimes in like interior monologues, sometimes remembering what they learned back in school or something like that, and then seeing an application. And what's really interesting is he doesn't worry like a Cobblestone would with like, I got to present this, you know, exactly the way it was, you know, what Nietzsche was saying. He'll pick up on whatever he wants and he'll use it, sometimes deforming it in the process, but oftentimes revealing to us sides that we're kind of missing out on. Yeah. And so I think that what goes on in his works, you know, we get to see ordinary people engaging with philosophical ideas in a way that you'd like to see happening in, you know, like an intro class, but he's not doing it at an intro level either. He's doing it at a graduate level.
Yeah.
So, you know, to come back to the question, does that make you a philosopher? I don't know. I think it's better to look at him like a Dostoevsky, like somebody who knows a lot of philosophy, has thought an awful lot about it, but is more concerned with writing good stories, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great point, Greg, because it doesn't seem like he's trying to teach us a lesson. And if it is, it's not on the nose. There's he has this book.
It's not Time straightforward.
Right. Are you familiar with Time Out of Joint?
Mm-hmm.
So in there, he doesn't tie up most of his books. He doesn't tie up all the loose ends. And you're like, wait, what happened here? In Time Out of Joint, you find out that, you know, he's in, what's that movie with Jim Carrey?
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Is that
one's close to it, Truman Show. It's basically Truman Show, right?
Yeah.
But so you go, okay, fine. You know, he had his memory repressed, and you know, he's really mapping out bombs and stuff. But there's this weird scene where time stopped, and he went to like a lemonade stand or something like that, and he found these words. They were just words on paper, and he all these like items out in reality started turning into just the words. And you're like, there's something there with like philosophy of language type stuff and concepts and how we view the world and maybe some Kant in there, like, this is going to be crazy when he reveals what he's doing here. And he just doesn't tie it up. And you're like, wait,
yeah.
What happened with the little slips of paper with words on them? And he's collecting them. And you just, no, it doesn't resolve.
Yeah. I mean, this is a little bit of a tangent to that, but I think you could think of like what a lot of his characters are going through as they're not just philosophical thought experiments, which are rather short, like maybe a paragraph to two pages, but they're more like, well, what if this really was the case? How would things pan out? You know, that's what's going on in a lot of the stories, you know, like what would be the, I mean, so think about Man in the High Castle. What would be the case if historically the Nazis and the Imperial Japanese had won the war? And what would be the case if, like, there were multiple dimensions that you could move one to the other stuff like that, you know?
Well, so in the show they do that, but in the book I was so unclear on were they in the world and they were all just confused and they're like, oh yeah, wait, no, Hitler did lose, or were they in a different reality? Like,
well, right, the show was kind of heavy-handed in that respect, right?
Totally,
it like plays out all this stuff happening in different dimensions. It is in there in the book, but it's only sort of hinted at. This is where of course they don't have movies either. It's all books, right?
Yeah.
Rather than movies. But the novel is charting out our world, and a world like our world, not exactly our world, in which the Allies had won. There's another thing too that Dick actually said, really interesting, in a radio, or not a radio interview, but like a taped interview. He talks about, you know, because the Oracle plays such a big role, the I Ching in that book.
He
said he used the Oracle to write the book. And then in the interview, he said, I quit doing that because the Oracle lies to you.
Yeah.
So what parts are true and what parts are not? Right, there's often this kind of fuzziness left after we're done with a Dick novel.
Yeah,
you know,
well, so thinking about so for those who don't know, for the listeners, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is the book behind Blade Runner, and like all book nerds say, the book's better. You know, I like the
totally
movies and
better.
Stuff. Just there's so many things that they missed, that they left out, and one of them is mercerism.
Yeah.
And for the listener, man, go check out Greg's YouTube channel, Gregory B. Sadler. Right. You have four or five, maybe six, seven episodes on this book
on the Android's Dream of Electric Sheep. I want to say eight.
Okay.
That might be the right number. I mean, they'll find it. No matter
what. Go find it. Yeah. But the this idea of mercerism doesn't make it in the movie at all. And mercerism is like this religion of empathy.
Yep.
And it doesn't make it in, but it's this huge play. This huge like kind of battle of ideas between like the humans who are empathizing so much so that they're going into this little like box and they're using it almost like a drug, and the androids who don't empathize, and that's like this battle of ideas going on behind just the killing of androids, you know?
Yeah, and the androids don't empathize with each other, which is why they can be turned against each other. The only thing that really survives in the movie is the Voight Kampff test, right? Yeah. That we see at the very beginning, which gets used a whole bunch of times in the novel. And I think only gets used at the very beginning of Blade Runner itself.
Yeah. Enhance.
Yeah. And I don't remember the recent one. Did they use that?
Yeah. They did. For K, he would have to come in and they would say like, you're way off, your levels are way off. And somehow he was supposed to like control his emotions or something like that.
Yeah. But it's supposed to measure your empathetic reaction to the torture, cruelty, or destruction of animals, which the androids don't have. Leaving that out of the movie. I mean, there's so many things. I'm going to do an episode eventually about differences between the book and the movie, because I'm kind of bothered by how much I like the movie as a teenager and a college student. And how much was missing from the movie that Ridley Scott, I guess, didn't think was worth putting in.
Yeah.
You know, It's weird too that Dick himself was so complacent about. He was like, "Yeah, great movie," you know.
Right. He did. I think he was helping with the screenplay, and it's like, dude, you missed all your stuff though. All this like,
yeah, isn't that kind of a strange? And I mean, he was so sensitive to so many things, and then, I mean, this is towards the end of his life, of course, right? He's going to die of a stroke before the movie actually comes out, but so maybe there was something wrong with him before that.
Yeah, it could be. So I found your episode so helpful just because, well, partially because, it's just nice to have someone else talk about this stuff because people are like, oh yeah, it's great. But it's like, wait, Philip K. Dick is the kind of author where you read the book and you have to go talk about it. That's why there's dickheads out there because they're like, well, I need to ask someone about this. You know, Beyond Lies the Wub, one of his short stories is like, what happened here? What's going on? Yeah, I need to know. Do you think this too? And, With Mercer, something that you brought out in one of your videos, Mercer, it seems like he does bring back this spider. It seems like he has powers in the world, but he's debunked by the androids. The androids show out, they show that what everyone took to be Mercer was just an actor and he was just some like drunk. But then they said, no, and Mercer agreed to it, but he was like, look, some things still have power, even though you can debunk them.
It doesn't change anything is how it's put. And the androids don't understand that it's not going to change anything. Right. Mm. Because they're very, very smart and they're incredibly sophisticated, but there's some things that they just don't get. And Mercer shows up too, to help Deckard deal with the android that's the most difficult for him, the one who's modeled after Rachel Rose and the Pris android, right?
And he gives him like revelation. He like tells him something that he couldn't know without Mercer being there, like she's around the corner or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah. And so he's doing, so there's like two things to that, right? He's giving him, like you said, some privileged information about the universe. And at the same time, there's a why behind it. Why is he doing this? Why is he singling out this one guy? It's not that he like has an irrational hate for androids because they debunked him. It's more like this is preserving life, and that's what Mercerism is fundamentally about: is solidarity with other living things. I mean, there is something that I find kind of troubling reading this through. And it was posed in the early chapters when Deckard is talking with his boss and then has to go and apply the Voight-Kampff test at the Rosen Corporation, and he applies it to Rachel Rosen, who is an android, right?
Yeah.
And before the revelation comes about, she's like, you would have, you know, he tests and he's like, she's an android. And she's like, I'm not an android. You would have killed me, right? Yeah. So what do we do with people that are lacking empathetic reactions because of, you know, trauma that they've had, or maybe they just, you know, there's some sort of biological.
Parents. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Do we say that they're not effectively human? They're just androids. I think Dick was really worried about that.
Yeah. Well, and that's what's so cool about this book, that he kind of ratchets things up and says, look, I have trouble saying that he's trying to teach a lesson, because I have this theory that he just doesn't do that. He doesn't wrap things up. But there is a lesson in, like, his Voight-Kampff test is an obvious allusion to the Turing test. But the Turing test is all about just, can you fool someone intellectually?
Yeah. Yeah,
this is like, you can't, no, this is emotion. This is deeper. Who cares about the intellect here? This is about the soul or something.
Yeah. The other test that they have in it, I forget the first name, it's the something Bonelli test.
Yeah, yeah.
Has to do with more mechanical stuff. Like it has to do with something with like a reflex that you have. Mm-hmm. So you got like three possibilities: cognitive, you know.
Yeah.
Affective, and then just purely mechanical.
Yeah. It's like Plato's trichotomy.
The tripartite soul.
Yeah.
Except, you know, one of the things that I do like about Plato's anthropology is the rational part of the soul is not just this cool, you know, calculating part. Yeah. It's got its own desires and its own pleasures.
Yeah.
So you're you know, like it needs things to be a certain way. It wants things to be a certain way.
Yeah.
You know,
it's not just like Spock. Well, maybe even exactly. Spock's not like Spock. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Another thing, maybe, I don't know if this is like common knowledge, but it seems like Mercer is like an allusion to Sisyphus.
I can see the resemblance in that he's going up a hill, right?
And he's like Jesus, like he's like a Jesus Sisyphus, like he's suffering on our behalf, kind of.
Yeah, and his suffering gets repeated over and over again. Yeah. And we're if we grasp the handles of the empathy box, we're being invited to like go along on the ride. But he's not been condemned to it the way Sisyphus was. And he, you know, Sisyphus is all by himself, whereas Mercer, we're all in it together, right?
Yeah. That Dick's idea about empathy is so fascinating. A lot of times I'll get heat from people. They'll say empathy is either, you can't actually do it because you can't get inside someone else's feelings. So sympathy, you know, we need sympathy, or it's somehow wrong to want to do that. And Dick's like, no, we're actually having this fusion. Let's go all in. We're fusing and feeling each other's feelings. And it plays such a huge part in this book that
I think it's Androids, a word.
Yeah. Don't
that people use, there is no consensus use of the word empathy. Okay. When you look at the literature that's out there and, very often you'll see people doing a lot of writing, like in self-helpy kind of stuff. And then they'll tell you what they think empathy is and how like there's like two different kinds or four different kinds or pick whoever's theory you want. And I think that Dick is using it in a very broad sense to encompass a couple other things that we might not necessarily place under empathy. But yeah, I mean, the people who, if somebody tries to tell me that empathy is overrated, you can't really put yourself in another person's shoes, I'm more like, well, I know that you can't, and I'm not going to walk down a dark alley with you because you just like gave me the tell, but that doesn't mean that the rest of us don't have it.
Wow. That's good. So, that's really good.
Yeah.
So one of the big, points, I don't know if it's a point or not, but you can help me.
Sure.
One of the big points is that the androids, they don't empathize with each other, even though they kind of do. Like you brought that out in your video. It's like, oh, they kind of do though. But it's not the same way maybe that we empathize with each other. But
they don't
empathize with the animals. And we find this out because not Pris, but what's her name?
Imgarden. Yeah.
The real Rachel Rosen comes in and throws the sheep off the roof.
Oh, that too. Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, thinking of the spider, but
yeah. Well, so she throws it off the roof and it's like devastating for me. It's not the happy ending you get in some of the Blade Runner extended cuts or whatever, but it was so devastating because he did all this work and she just killed the sheep. And it's like, oh man. And they show their value. They show their status in society by what kind of animals they keep. And that's my kind of thing. I have like, 20 turtles and I have a dog.
Oh, really?
I love animals. So for me, I'm looking at this and I'm saying, okay, as an animal lover myself, I keep endangered species, which I have permits for them. So relax, DNR. But I'm trying to breed endangered turtles and help, repopulate Illinois.
Okay.
But so for me, looking at from that perspective, I'm like, Philip K. Dick is showing us what it means to be human. Part of being human is empathizing with animals. And even if you're the most intelligent person in the world, but you don't empathize with animals, there's something lacking in your humanity. And I'm like, maybe that's totally me reading in because I'm a turtle guy, you know?
Well, there's a lot there. I mean, it's interesting because turtles are not the go-to, I think, for most people when they're thinking about like, it's dogs and cats, right?
Totally.
And then maybe birds, or maybe horses or something like that. But we tend to think about reptiles. Well, they're reptilian. They're cold. They don't care about anything. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. And we're learning more and more. I think that throughout most of history, it's partly because we just didn't have the footage, right? I mean, you go onto YouTube and you can see all this interesting stuff about interspecies friendships taking place, So we have an access that I think a lot of most people lacked in the past and had to just rely on like folklore about animals. But yeah, I mean, there is something not necessarily like every single animal, the way that Mercerites yeah. are. I mean, they're also in a situation of artificial scarcity. Most of the animals have died off. They're very precious, right? So if you and I lived in a world in which, you know, even mosquitoes were rare, maybe we wouldn't like slap the mosquito, you know?
Yeah, right.
Whereas I don't have any problem doing that right now, you know? Yeah. And you know, I'm an arachnophile. I like spiders,
okay.
but I'll kill a brown recluse as soon as I see it, or even a hobo spider, because they're kind of like them, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So with us, it's a different, we live in a different kind of world, and we know many, many people who are not empathetic to animals, and it can be in part because they lack a certain maturity. Children are often very cruel to animals, and not because they're necessarily traumatized. They just like to pick up a grasshopper and they're like, what happens if I pull its leg off? You know?
Right.
And then they need adults to tell them, you know, that's not cool. Don't do that. You know?
Yeah.
Or, you know, the kid with the magnifying glass burning the ants, right?
Yeah. Is that because their capacity for empathy isn't there yet? Or is that something that like you think necessarily needs to be taught?
I think it's complex. And I think a lot of children, part of what it means to be immature is to be thoughtless. You know, if somebody comes up to you and they're like, hey, what are you doing to that animal? And then they're suddenly like, oh, what am I doing to this animal? I shouldn't do that, right?
Yeah.
But until then, they're kind of working along the lines of something, you know, kind of like a robot, just following out programming. And then there can be like all sorts of damage that's done through trauma that hardens people and makes them, you know, maybe cruel, because that's a way to feel like you're on top of things or to feel alive or stuff like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's a real challenge to grow into a person who is empathetic without just being a ball of mush.
Yeah.
You know,
man, that's true. That is, that's a tricky one. Yeah. Grace and truth. Well, so Greg, I wanted to finish up with one, final question. I think I gathered that you went to a Catholic high school cause your sub was teaching Augustine. Is that?
Yeah. Although, like a lot of Catholic high schools of that time in the 1980s, it was a lot of lip service. And, you know, I get these brochures from them and they're like, you know, look at all the stuff that we're doing at Catholic Memorial, you know, living a life of charity. I'm like, where the hell was that when I was there? There wasn't anything remotely like that. There was all this bullying going on and, you know, all this just kind of, what would you call it? Like superficial Catholic culture, you know?
Sure. Sure.
But what was the actual question?
Yeah. Well, so just a question about the role of philosophy of religion in philosophy. Like, is it a subsidiary? Is it the queen of the philosophy science? Like what role do philosophy of religion type questions? Is there a God? What does that play?
I mean, I think within philosophy itself, it's not the queen of the sub-philosophical disciplines. It's one among many, right? Mm-hmm. And there's often a lot of overlaps with other disciplines. Like, you're going to do metaphysics? Well, it's important whether there's a God or not, or how causality works, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, philosophy of religion is itself kind of, it's something that got reconstructed later on. It shows up primarily from like as philosophy of religion as a discipline from the 19th century onward, right?
Yeah.
But people were doing all sorts of stuff that fits into the philosophy of religion without calling it that. They called it, you know, other things. Philosophy also has to think about its relationship with other disciplines, like, which could include theology or history or the fine arts. And then it also has to clarify its own relation with important areas of human life. Like, theology is not the same thing as religion, right? Mm-hmm. There are atheist theologians out there.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But, you know, if you're a philosopher, you do have to take what Maurice Blondel called the religious hypothesis seriously at some point, unless you grew up in a, like a totally secularized environment, or, you know, you're just irrationally hostile to religion and won't take it seriously at all. Yeah. But I mean, that doesn't mean that every single philosopher has to, you know, think about big religious issues in order to do philosophy.
Yeah. Do you think every philosopher ought to have an opinion on God's existence?
Oh, I don't know.
Oughts are tough.
Yeah. I mean, I'm willing to say that because there's a lot of people who are very narrowly specialized and they just do their shtick with their, you know, reading their 10 articles over and over again that are common in that field. And maybe the 11th will get added five years down the line. And I don't want to say that those people aren't doing philosophy. I don't want to exclude them from the field, right?
Yeah.
Do they have to think about issues in the philosophy of religion if they're just doing analytic philosophy of action? I don't think so.
Mm.
As a person,
yeah.
Now, I mean, every philosopher is also a person.
Yeah.
Maybe sooner or later you have to develop some sort of position on that. But a lot of things like that, you know, our positions are kind of loosey-goosey, just kind of not well thought out. And I, you know, what comes to mind right now is thinking about Augustine. He talks in the Confessions about when he first started praying, and it was because he didn't want to get beaten. So he would pray to God, you know, let me remember my lessons, or don't let these people beat me. And they were pretty terrible to the kids back then. And they had the same thing, like, well, this worked for us, you know.
Yeah.
We turned out just fine, you know, let the beatings commence, right?
Yeah.
He says at a couple different points, the God that I was praying to, obviously the God didn't hear me because it was like a figment of my imagination. Now, this is a guy who is a Catholic theologian who, you know, when you hear somebody like that saying that, you're like, whoa, what's going on there? Right.
Yeah.
Well, he's acknowledging that a lot of our understandings of God that we like pray to, or we react against, or stuff like that, are basically just they're not related at all to whatever the thing out there, if it exists, you know, whatever God would be, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's part of what holds a lot of people back from considering these big questions. I mean, if your idea of God is like big father in the sky and your father was a jerk, why would you want to have anything to do with God? Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I mean, in theology, that's a huge deal. If God is calling himself father and he's put fathers in the world to represent him, and you misrepresent God by beating your kid or being a terrible father, like, that's a really big deal, you know? So,
Yeah,
it's totally right. Yeah,
you know, to swing back, I mentioned that I taught, you know, at Indiana State Prison, and I would hang out with the other teachers, and some of them taught theology, and they were, you know, Ball State was a secular state institution, but Grace College was there as well, and this guy would talk about his classes and exactly that, how he would have to wean these anywhere from like 20 to 60 year old men away from conceptions of a father who was either like, you know, absent or drunk all the time, or would beat the crap out of them and their mom and their siblings, or would spend all the household money, or
brought them into the crime world himself. Oh,
exactly.
Yeah, man. That last point about from Augustine, like praying to a God that doesn't exist. It's so interesting, and I think for those who hate analytic philosophy, like this is where like definite descriptions and rigid designators come in. Like, well, do you think that your word for God like finds its way to God, or if
your
description's wrong, does it not? You know, and it doesn't refer. I love that stuff. So I will just drop a last analytic philosophy is not so bad to the listener. Yeah. This is awesome. Well, Greg, man, thanks so much for giving me your time here. This has been super fun. I'd love to have you back on. Please come back on.
We can talk more about
Philip K. Dick stuff. Before I let you go, though, I'm sure if you're listening to this, you already know about Greg. But if you don't, can you tell us, like, where can they find you? What's your channel like?
Well, the easiest thing is just type Gregory Sadler into Google. There's a few others out there. Actually, I'm going to do a video eventually about the other Greg Sadlers.
Nice.
But to their detriment, I have dominated the Google rankings. So like all the stuff will come up, you know. I mean I have the video channel, which is just called Gregory B. Sadler. I have a podcast called Sadler's Lectures that people can find, and I do some writing on Medium, and it's all of it's really easy to find just with Google. Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't be like necessarily advocating the, you know, the big conglomerate corporation.
I know, but what would Philip K. Dick say about us right now? Yeah,
exactly.
That's so good. That's so good. Well, thanks so much, man. This has been fantastic. That's going to have to do it for now. This has been Parker's Pensies, and as always, all glory to God.